You're listening to Early Doors Football Podcast with host Mark Roach and co-hosts Dylan Kerr, Tom Watt and Sherelle Casal, a For The Now Media production.
Welcome to the Early Doors Football Podcast. A big welcome to all the listeners. Welcome to this week's early episode. I want to wish everybody... Oh, no, I don't want to say that one, so let's see things. I want to welcome everybody... I want to welcome everybody to the Early Doors Football Podcast. Hi, I'm Dylan Kerr, and we've got some great guests for you this week. But first, it's time for...
Highlight of the Week.
Pogba tackled Henderson. What a pass that is for Mo Salah. Is this going to be the hat-trick? It certainly is. It's five, inside 5 minutes of the second half.
And courtesy of Sky Sports, that was...
Highlight of the Week.
Before we introduce our first guest, I'd like to come to you first, Tom, if that's all right. You're obviously well known as Lofty and EastEnders, as we all know, but you've got plenty of other strings to your bow, I think that's fair to say, including charity football, which you've mentioned. And I know you played for, there was an EastEnders team, wasn't there? And I think you also turned out for an Arsenal Legends team as well, didn't you?
Well, I did start the Wolford Boys Club, as the EastEnders charity team was called. We did start that probably 88 sometime, something like that, 87, 88, when really there wasn't much of that about. But, oh, blimey. It was, we had just the best time, you know, because that was when the show was really big. We would turn up places and we'd have, you know, crowds of like 10, 15,000 turning out. Do you know what I mean? And there'd be trips to Scotland, trips to Jersey, all around London. You know, we were going all over the country. And the thing was, because I ran the team, all I ever said to people, like people would get in touch and ask for a game, I'd say, that's fine. Whatever you want to raise money for, not a problem. All you've got to do is get us to the ground and get us back to my flat in Islington again afterwards. And that's it. That's all you've got to do. Everything else that you make, do you know what I mean? Everything else, that's yours. You just do what you want. We're just there for a game of football. And we had, there were one or two lads on the show who could play a bit. One of them actually, he's had a fantastic career subsequently as an actor, a guy called Jason Watkins, who, even if you don't know who he is, you would recognise him, trolleyed and all sorts of stuff he's done. But he was a pro at Wrexham when he was, I think he turned first year pro, played a couple of games, got a really bad leg break. And when he came back, he couldn't tackle. Do you know what I mean? He had that fear. And so he knocked it on the head and went to acting. But we had two or three who could play. And then we got a couple of ringers in. You're probably both too young to remember a guy called Tony Kay. But Tony Kay was the captain of the Everton team that won the league in 64-65. And would probably have played... He would probably have played in the England team in 1966 because he could do everything that Nobby Stiles did, but he was great on the ball as well. Do you know what I mean? But he got done in a... It was like a match-fixing scandal in 65 from when he'd been playing for Sheffield Wednesday, and he got banned for life. But he did come and... sort of however much later, he was 64, 65 by the time he turned out for us. But he was still, you know, still fit. He'd gone and lived in Spain for a while, running, and, you know, he could still... And obviously, you don't lose the ability and being able to see the game and stuff. Good, good lad. Loved a game of football at 65. And then on that, he got one cap for England. And this is incredible. This is how the FA used to be. So he got a cap for England. So when the FA had their 100th anniversary, it was a game at Wembley, an England game, and they invited every living player who had been capped by England, including Tony Kay. So he went and did all the blah, blah, all of this. Anyway, a few weeks later, Tony gets booked in a charity game because he did like a tackle, to be fair. Got booked in a charity game. I got a letter from the FA saying, oh, it has been brought to our attention that Anthony Kay was yellow carded, you know, was cautioned. Then you, if this is the same Anthony Kay that we believe it is, we are writing to advise you that he is currently serving the terms of a sin DA ban, i.e. lifetime ban, and you must desist from selecting him. Otherwise, your team will be kicked out of the London FA.
Wow.
And you go, hang on. 3 weeks ago, you had him up to Wembley because he was an England player. And now you're saying, and I wrote him back and I said, so, and I never heard anything again. And obviously Tony didn't stop playing, but that was how the FA used to be. So yeah, I had that team. But then also I used to turn out, there was an Arsenal vets team, which was, and you know, vets football is supposed to be 35 and over. Yeah. Well, I wasn't 35, but I was so rubbish. It was like I was playing off a handicap. Do you know what I mean? They let me play, even though I wasn't quite 35, because I was shit. But that meant I played, you know, I was in kind of a back line. Pat Rice, Frank McClintock, me, and Sammy Nelson. Do you know what I mean? These are the players I grew up. John Radford, George Armstrong. I mean, these are players I grew up watching. They were the people that got me hooked on the Arsenal in the first place. And I end up actually playing alongside them. It was brilliant. So what happened was I left the show and kind of didn't really have the time to run the team. But we had EastEnders people, other actors, used to draw good crowds. The Arsenal vets, they had really good players, but they didn't draw the crowds. And so what we did in about 1991. We put the two together and it became the Arsenal Ex-Professional and Celebrity 11. And that team is still going to this day. So it's just celebrated its 30th anniversary. So I did like a bit of charity football, me, because obviously if there was anything at stake, then I would never have got a game because I was so shit. And I had to run the team. Otherwise, I wouldn't have got picked. That was my... Yeah, that was the trade-off. I would organise everything. Everybody would come meet my flat and we'd get in the minibus, go off to the game or, you know, go to the airport or whatever it was. But if I was organising, then I got to play, right?
Yeah.
Because I'd set it all up.
But how was it? I mean, we're the same, you know. How was it with your, you know, playing with your football heroes? You know, okay, on the back of EastEnders, on the back of your football... personality. How was it for you playing with Sammy Nelson, with Frank McClintock? Who was goalkeeper?
It was unbelievable. It was absolutely unbelievable. No, I can't remember who was in goal. It weren't who used to play in goal for us? I can't remember, actually. It wasn't Pat or Bob or any of those. This is what I'm saying. It's like dream come true stuff, isn't it? And the thing was, even though I was rubbish, for about 6-7 years, till I did my ACL, I was playing 60 plus games a year. So even though I was rubbish, I was fit as a butcher's dog. So I could keep up with games. Do you know what I mean? So it kind of worked. And they knew I wasn't very good. So if I got the ball, then, you know, there'd always be someone who was half decent to give it to. And it was, it was great. It was, you dream about that stuff, didn't you? Because those heroes don't ever get replaced. You know, those people I saw do the double for Arsenal in 71, win the Fairs Cup in 70. Those were my heroes. I was 14, 15 years old. Yeah. That was it. They were, and they still are. You know, they still are. I can still reel off the team that did the double. And, you know, all of those, Peter Story used to play as well, Eddie Kelly. I mean, these are not names for the kids, obviously, but it was absolutely, you know, you grow up watching these people from the clock end, and then however long it is later, 20 odd years later, you're having a kick around with them on a Sunday afternoon. How can you beat that?
Is there a modern version of, like, with Arsenal and EastEnders and the other celebrities?
Kind of changed over the years. And now it's the EastEnders connection doesn't really exist particularly anymore. And I don't have anything to do with the team now, not with running it and stuff. That's all taken care of by the community department at Arsenal. But it's still a mix of kind of people off telly, the odd ex-pro, do you know what I mean? Friends and family. And they're still, you know, still playing lots of fixtures on the same basis. I don't think 10 or 15,000 people turn out to watch them anymore, to be fair. But that was, it was just a time, do you know what I mean? And that really, you know, you look at all the stuff that's happened since, all the kind of soccer aid and all those other things, you know, that was absolutely where it started.
I think it's time now to introduce our first guest, and it's someone you know, Dylan, from your playing days in Scotland. So I'll leave the honours to you.
We'd like to introduce you to Stevie Farrell, a very, very old Scottish friend of mine and currently the manager of Dumbarton FC in Scotland. Hiya, Stevie.
Hi, Dylan. How are you?
I'm good, pal. You're live in South... Well, you're on podcast. I'm in South Africa, as you know. You're probably
very good now in Scotland. I'm actually sat in my office, Dylan. I'm sat in my office in Glasgow right now, the city centre, so I'm sat here.
Oh, well,
Dumbarton
got office now in Glasgow. Been a long time, Steve, before we started. It's been, nearly probably 20 years since we crossed paths when we were playing, you know, way back in the day. And you know, we were speaking to Mark earlier. You know, this is it's just a catch up with football people, like minded in what we love, and basically see where you are, what you're doing, and how's it been for the past 20 years. we know you're at Dumbarton Football Club now. I mean, how's it going so far?
It's good, Dylan. I mean, obviously, we came in very late. I mean, we actually didn't take over till late in the pre-season schedule, and we probably only had about 3 or 4 weeks, and we had a small window because of how late we took over, and we only had 2 players signed. So it was a mad rush as such, you know, to your coin a Scottish phrase. It was a mad rush to get people in the door. You know, there was a lot of engagement with agents and players over that 4 or 5 weeks. But I think we've brought in about 21 players, which is a big turnover in a first-team squad. 14 points a quarter in League One, for the all my experience in League One's a decent first quarter, and particularly when you consider how many players were brought to the club in such a short time. I'm delighted with the start.
No, let's see, it's one of these, Dumbarton's one of these clubs that, you know, it's kind of weird. You know, I look for the killed man at score, and then you want to, you know, you look at obviously the Rangers Celtic scores, but, you know, in the lower leagues, it's always like Dumbarton, Stranraer, and Stenhouse Muir for me, because I know the goalkeeper coach, David Benny. So it's always, you know, and Dumbarton's got a fantastic ground. I love that ground. You know, it's if people could actually see it from an aerial view, you know, it's one of the best Scottish grounds in Britain, to be fair. You know, so I do, and I've enjoyed playing there. In fact, last time I played there, I scored. How's it been though, since, you know, taking over so late, getting that mad rush to get players in, and how's it been, you know, post-COVID, pre-COVID, and all that up to now? How have you found it professionally and personally? How have you found it?
It was difficult. I mean, obviously, when the COVID hit, I was at Stranraer as manager, Dylan, and that was difficult. It was difficult for the full of Scottish football. I mean, I was on record publicly and saying that I don't think it was managed for the governing bodies as well as it could have been in relation to football, i.e. the SPFL and the SFA. And I went on record as saying that, and with a number of other managers, I may add. So I think we could have handled that better as governing bodies within the football fraternity in Scotland. But listen, it's now over. We're through the other end of that. And you know, even on Saturday, players are not allowed showers. I don't know whether you're aware of that, but we're still having the difficulties of players after games. We went all the way to Peterhead, and officially you're still not allowed showers for players. Do you know? So there's still that pandemic is hanging over Scottish football, and it's difficult because it's no like you and I have been brought up with and known and understood. Even simple things like going to speak to the manager after the game. You know, we were always in managers' rooms having a chat before. You know, the years gone by, it was a bottle of beer, it was a cup of coffee. Now you don't even have that interaction, Dylan. Do you know, have that interaction in each other's room after the game or before the game. And me personally, having done that for a number of years, I miss that interaction, and I'm sure other managers miss it also. Now, I seen Ian McCall actually saying that about him and Jim Duffy and Partick Vieira. and he said he had missed going in with managers and having a cup of coffee, a bottle of beer. Do you know, just the simple things. And the pandemic has really affected that. It's really affected it, and we're still in the aftermath of that as such in Scotland.
I think this is why this show's so good. Because what we do is, you know, we know probably the listening public that tune into this don't understand that's not happening. You know, here in South Africa, you know, they don't have showers after the game anyways. You know, they come off come out of the game. There's very, very little interaction with the opposite coaches. It's totally different in South Africa. You know, you'll see them as you're walking out, as they're getting onto the bus, as you're getting onto your bus, and then we're straight back to the hotel, and that's where they get changed and showered and leave to go home. But you know, it's strange. I do miss that. You know, it's a different way of doing things in Southern Africa. You know, and I say I do miss that. I miss having a chat with managers, with coaches. You know, win or lose, you know, you always have that banter with them. You know, and it's good to hear. Well, it's good to hear, but it's strange to hear that you go to Peterhead and the players are not allowed to shower. I mean, do they just get on the bus and then like they do here?
Yeah, they tool themselves down after the game and then get ready and just go on the bus, Dylan. Do you know? But as you know, I mean, the culture here has always been, you know, that's part and parcel. You get in the shower after the game and win, lose or draw, you have your banter on the shower and then you get ready and on the bus. And then for long journeys such as Peterhead, the boys will have a couple of beers and you know, switch off for the weekend. But all those things have been affected by COVID. And that is what it is. We've just got to live with it. So for that point of view, it's changed dramatically.
Is it still part-time or is it full-time now, Dumbarton?
Still part-time, Dylan. Most of League One, I think Falkirk, Queen's Park are the only two full-time clubs in League One. The rest of us are all part-time.
And how do you find that?
It's difficult, Dylan. I mean, we've both been full-time as footballers, you know, and when you're a full-time footballer, you've got nothing else. It's your life and you're totally committed to that. Part-time players have got lives, they've got families, and they're still trying to manage being at a really good level in football. Because when you go and play the likes of Falkirk and Queen's Park as full-time clubs, they're big clubs, you know, the biggest. And we've got to go as part-time clubs. We're only training twice a week in comparison to their four or five times a week. So you've got to make sure that you try and be as fit as you possibly can at a part-time level. You try and keep the players as focused as you possibly can. But it's difficult because they've got day jobs as well. Do you know, and a lot of people forget that. And that's always been my thing about Scottish football. Dylan, I think it's 49% of clubs are part-time in Scotland. Do you know, and Scottish football, and they look at Celtic, and they look at Rangers, and they look at St Johnstone, Kilmarnock, and all those clubs, and St Mirren, and the full-time clubs, and it's great. But nearly 50% of your clubs, of your professional clubs, are part-time. And there's not enough focus and attention, and probably, in my opinion, respect given to that.
Yeah, because it's, again, you know, I can't compare, you know, African football to Scottish football, but you know, I haven't. I'll be honest, you know, since I was fortunate to play at Kilmarnock when we had a very, very good team, and I came up to Scotland, and spent four very good years, and I thought Scottish football was going up, you know, and then all of a sudden, you know, the money came in through TV, and then all of a sudden the product just went, you know, downhill from me. And I still think it's going that way, you know. But I'm an outsider now, you know, in another country, but with still, you know, that passion that what's happening in Scotland. And don't get me wrong, Stevie, I'd swap roles with you in a heartbeat if that opportunity came. But do you feel? I mean, for me, it's very, very difficult to get into football in Scotland because I don't think recognise what I've done in Africa, but. How do you feel from a progression point of view, you know, over the last 20 years? I mean, you've been at Stranraer, you've been doing so many things in football. Do you feel like there's you get to a certain point and you can't get any further, or do you understand what I'm saying?
I do, and I think, listen, I think it's human nature, Dylan. I think there's a boardroom mentality that's different from a dressing room mentality. And I don't think that'll ever change. And that's not been critical of either of those environments. Do you know, it's just there is a difference in mentality. And if I look my own predicament. You know, I came from Stranraer, went to Dumbarton. Do I have aspirations to go full-time? Absolutely. Do I think I could go full-time? Absolutely. Would I feel comfortable in a full-time environment coaching full-time footballers? Absolutely. But you've got to be given that opportunity. You've got to be given that opportunity. And sometimes, that you know, somebody who's played in the Premier League 450, 500 times will be considered possibly a better option than somebody who's played in the Championship League One. And that's that mentality you speak about. It's not an elitism mentality, but it's a different mentality. And until we break through that mentality and give young, aspiring coaches who have possibly not played as much in the Premier League that opportunity. But, I mean, I've now been doing this 10 years. I think I'm probably the third or fourth longest serving, if you take my continuous service between Stranraer and Dumbarton, the third or fourth longest serving manager in Scotland. But there'll still not be people that don't know me. Do you know, and that's a fact. Do you know, even in my own country, there'll be people that, if you say, who's the Dumbarton manager, they'll say, I don't know. But if I'd played in the Premier League 400 or 500 times, they would know me straight away. So it's how we square that hole, and that's a difficult one to square, because we're relying on people and human nature to square that, and that's more difficult.
Yeah, because I'm not jealous. I'm not envious of the football management roundabout, but it seems to be, you know, as you said, you know, you've been one of the longest serving Scottish managers in football, and yet, you know, when jobs come up, you know, it just seems like, you know, the same people go around and around, whether they've been successful or mostly have not been successful, they've been fired, you know, they keep, you know, getting these jobs, you know, and sometimes you think, well, you know, what do I have to do to break, you know, to break down that wall and get an opportunity?
Players, I think players, I don't own a football club and I'm not a chairman of a football club, but if I was, I would probably do Mayor's research with players, because I don't think players are tapped into enough when they're talking about bringing a new manager or coach to your football club. Because, you know, Dylan, you've worked with managers, and without naming names, you will speak in circles and say, by the way, best coach ever worked with, best manager, how good was he? You'll also say, nah, no, for me, do you know, our players didn't engage with him, didn't. So that's experiences. That's experiences of players. And ultimately, players make the world go round. Players are what football is about. And I just think that market and that fraternity, the player fraternity, is not tapped into enough with research when you're bringing a new football manager to your club. Because if you went and asked players about different coaches at the lower level or younger coaches, then they would probably have a better understanding of what's there and what's an alternative to what might be in that merry-go-round.
Yeah, and what's your... So, you know, your plans, obviously, to get to Christmas and being that respectable top, you know, three... And then, so how do you get, with part-time players, probably a young squad as well, you know, how do you get that philosophy of what you want, and do you think you'll be able to achieve that by the end of this season?
I think if I'm looking at it just now, we've probably get one of the, because budgets is a lot. You know, it doesn't matter where you are in the world. You know, budgets are 9 times out of 10 are going to count to something and go a long way to where you finish in the league. So we probably get one of the lowest budgets in the league. But having said that, I do think we've built a squad that's capable of competing for that top four in the playoff positions. We're in and around about them at this moment in time. Do you know, but like everything, Dylan, I think somebody once said, I'd rather be a lucky manager than a good manager at times. And you need luck. Yeah. You need luck. You need luck with injuries. You need luck with suspensions. You need luck with injuries, in particular to key players. And if I can keep my key personnel fit and strong in that mixture of that experience and youth, in the key areas, and free for suspension, free for injury for now to Christmas, and still staying that there round about, then you can look at the next window and the last window, you know, going into the final part of the season to try and strengthen where you need. So if I'm lucky enough to keep people fit, I think we can compete from now to Christmas and then look at the last window, the last transfer window, hopefully, to get us over the line.
Well, like I said, I mean, look, I knew you were at Dumbarton, so obviously... You know, I always keep an eye out for, you know, like Gary Holt at Falkirk, you know, Gordon Forrest at Hearts, you know, just to, you know, because I've got a vested interest in these people, because I've met them, I've played with them, I've worked with them, I've coached with them. So it's always good to see, you know, that you do get a good result, you know, and obviously travelling up to Peterhead, it's a ball eight for one. And sometimes, you know, them games are the ones for me that you need you know, the away ones you need to win, you know. And I say I hope to God, you know, you do finish well this season, and then maybe another door will open. Not saying that you're going to leave the barn, you know, but that's what, you know, we all want to be, you know, I said lucky but successful, but that luck comes with hard work.
Absolutely does, Dylan. It comes, you know, the one thing that we instill in the players is a work ethic. You know, we need to have that work ethic. First and foremost, without out of possession, we've got to, you know, I always say this, we can be the best team in the league out of possession, whether we're part-time or full-time. We can be the best team in the league out of possession, and we need to have that work ethic to achieve that. And if we are at that level without the ball and out of possession, then with the players and the quality that I've got, I believe that we can go and continue with that challenge. So, you know, it's just about that momentum with the players and that continuous progress with the players. And it's just repetitive, you know that. You know, it's just repetitive. When things are going well and you've got a bit of momentum, don't change it. Just keep repeating it. Keep reminding people, but never lose those goals. You know, and we've set the goals at the start of the season in terms of every quarter where we want to be, points wise, clean sheets wise, so forth and so forth, and keep driving towards those goals. And that's what we'll try and do season after season.
I've just got to mention, because Mark's done his research, which is great. How come you always like signing for teams that begin in ST?
St. Mirren, Stennis, Muir, Stoke, Celtic. Listen, and I was murdered at them all as well. I was hopeless at every one of them, Dylan.
No, listen, he's you know, Mark's a good lad. He'll give me some info on things. I said, I only know him when he played him in Scotland, so you know that's as far as I know. So, how's the family? Everybody good?
Everybody's good, mate. Everybody's good. It's good. How yourself? You enjoying it? Is it? I know I've seen a couple of reports reading saying you would come back in a heartbeat and things like that. But are you enjoying it? And
I'm not working at the moment. I'm going through a case for unfair dismissal from not my previous club, the one before that. So that's been in what we call a dispute resolution committee with the Premier League. So I should find out that this month. But I love it out here. I'm living in Durban. I'm 5 minutes walk from the beach, 5 minutes walk from the golf course, and a 5 minute walk to the pub. So it's a good life at the moment. I'm in a happy place, Stevie. So, but we're going to continue this after. I'll have a chat to you just after, because we've got to wind this up now. But Stevie, thank you for coming on this show. I mean, it's going really, really well at the moment. So, you know, it gets you out there, gets your name out there. And for myself and Mark, you know, it's great to see you. I will get your number, so I'll keep in touch with you. You know, again, let's not make it 20 more years.
Absolutely. Good to speak to you guys. Good to speak to you, Don. Thanks very much, mate.
All the best for the season, pal.
Cheers, pal. Cheers.
And now I'm delighted to welcome to the Early Doors Football Podcast, Yang Liu, who's a Chinese football coach in the UK. Welcome, Yang. How are you?
Yeah, I'm good. Thank you.
And Yang, you're in the UK at the moment. You're in Manchester now, but previously you were in Paisley in Scotland, studying at the University of Western Scotland.
Yeah.
And I wanted to start by asking you first about your previous experience in China as a football coach. So you've worked as a performance analyst for the under-16s team at Greentown FC.
Yeah.
Before that, you were an academy coach for the under-14s at Shanghai Shenzhen. And hopefully I pronounced that okay.
Yeah,
so,
okay.
So just start by telling us a little bit about your background as a coach and a performance analyst, and you know, how that worked for you in China.
Yeah, I've introduced my experience from the very beginning. Before I went into the professional clubs, I worked in Beijing. I was a grassroots coach, and it's a part-time job. I only coached at weekends. In weekend, I work for a sport company to write some sports article and then put it onto website. And as I gained lots of experience in coaching, I found I should go into a professional football club or more professional organization, because I think football should be systematic, it would be better for youth player, for myself. So I took a chance to go into a professional club in Shanghai, and Shanghai is the best place for youth football, I think.
And what brought you to the UK then? What was your thinking behind coming to the UK?
It's related to my experience in China. At that time, I couldn't find some useful training content in China. Then I started to learn English, and I found lots of training content recorded by English. Then I used the method I found in English. I was thinking at that time, why can't I go into the UK to learn something more professional? And after 2 pieces of experience in working in professional club, I went into the UK for studying.
And what have you been studying in the UK?
My major is sport coaching. It's a master program. And I think the coaching would relate to the cultural aspects more. And previously, I thought it may be related to some strength and conditioning aspects, but I think I was wrong. And it's more about the cultural aspects. Yeah.
And what are your ambitions, Yang? What do you want to go on to achieve in football?
I think my plan has been changed. Previously, I want to be I want to go on to go on to coaching job in professional club, but it's difficult for me. You know, in China, if you don't have a professional player background, it's difficult to go into a professional club to be coaching. And although I think I have ability to coach, but there is no more chances for that. So I'm going to apply for a PhD in the UK to go on my studying here, and to gain some qualification such as course held by SFE, and it's about UEFA qualification, and to study some strength and conditioning coach course, which is in demand in China. And then I would go back to China to see if I can have more chances about football.
And just tell us, Yang, we know in Asia that football is very popular, but yeah. what about China? How popular is football in China?
I think when we have a national team game and the people are willing to see that on TV, and lots of amateur games happen on weekends, and one thing is affected football in youth because our children have to face a huge academic learning pressure. They don't have much time to play football. So I think that would affect football development in China.
And in terms of support for English clubs and clubs in Europe, is it fairly common that someone in China would have an English team to follow, or a team in Spain, for example? What type of what teams are people looking at from China in terms of support?
Manchester United, Arsenal, or Chelsea, I think these three clubs were the more popular in China.
Yeah, and do you support an English team, Yang?
Yeah, my favorite club is Manchester United.
Yeah, and how do you feel about them signing Ronaldo?
Ronaldo?
Yeah.
Oh, I think it's one of my favorite player, and he's famous from Manchester. So I think maybe going back to Manchester is a good choice for him, and I have to go on to follow him.
All right, Yang. Well, great to speak to you. It's really, really interesting to talk to you about, your view from someone from China in the UK. So great to speak to you. Thank you for being a guest on the Early Doors Football Podcast.
Thank you. It's my pleasure.
And now it's time for our weekly look at women's football with me, Sherelle Cassell. On Thursday, Louise Quinn's first half own goal saw Republic of Ireland lose 1-0 against Sweden, which unfortunately is a big loss. But however, being Republic of Ireland international previously, you know, it's still a huge improvement to when we used to play Sweden. Then on Friday, Scotland beat Hungary 2-1 with captain Rachel Corsi's 90th minute header maintaining Scotland's running one. Also on Friday, Katie's Green's second half equaliser earned Wales a 1-1 draw in Slovenia, but Wales finished with 10 plays after Green was sent off. England were 4-0 winners against Northern Ireland. Fantastic second half performance with Bean Cumberland sub, Beth Mead scoring a hat-trick in 14 minutes. Unbelievable, Beth Mead. And then, of course, Bethany England coming on, scoring. So next round of the World Cup qualifiers is Tuesday. Republic of Ireland away to Finland, which is 4:15 kickoff UK time. Then it's England away to Latvia, which is 6:30 kickoff UK time. Northern Ireland at home to Austria at 7 p.m. kickoff, and Wales at home to Estonia with a 7:15 kickoff. And Scotland are at home to Sweden in a friendly, which is 7:05 p.m. kickoff. So we've got an unbelievable person with us today, Ashley Goddard. What she's been through, how she's still coping, it's unbelievable. It's inspiring to me, it's inspiring to others. It gives me a pleasure to introduce you to Ashley Goddard. Previously played for Palace, previously played for Arsenal Academy. She's been abroad in Cyprus, and she's now currently playing for AFC Wimbledon. How are you today, Ashley? Are you okay?
I'm good, thank you. I'm good. How are you?
Yeah, very well, thank you. Very well. So, Ashley, tell everyone about yourself, you know, how you've been. You've got AVM, you're just kind of recovering from it. Tell us.
Basically, I'm the most unlucky person going at the moment. So I basically got knocked out during a game playing for Palace against London City. And I had symptoms for quite a while, just concussion. But the physio, Lila Brahm, she told me to go get a scan and make sure everything was okay and clear. And NHS, you have to wait a little bit. So by the time I got the results to that scan, I was actually already back playing, cleared of all symptoms. And they cleared me of anything to do with that specific incident, but they found by accident something called an AVM, which is basically a tangle of capillaries, blood vessels in the brain. So they sent me for, I got referred on and I got sent for another scan, and it was more in detail, and they could see that within the tangle, because the blood was flowing quite quickly into it, a bulge had formed, which is an aneurysm. So I had a brain AVM and an aneurysm without having any symptoms or knowing anything about it. I just got lucky that I got knocked out during that game and they found it.
So were you getting any pains beforehand, Ashley? Was there any kind of triggers to think that there was something going on?
No, absolutely nothing. Nothing at all. Just a freak find.
Yeah. And is that usually, I know you've done a lot of studying around AVMs, and I know it's AVM Awareness Month, October. Yeah. So just to kind of go into a bit more detail to it, have you heard of this before, or is this completely new to you and your family?
No, I'd never heard of it before. Obviously, when they tell you the diagnosis and you look into it, and about 1% of the population have it. So it is, you know, in percentage terms, it's rare. When you think of that as a number, it's actually very common. What makes it also rare is that most people, it's kind of like benign. It doesn't really affect people. They can live the whole life and never know they had it. Where I was rare is that we found it when we did. I'm only 29. So they found it young. And the scary thing about mine was that the aneurysm had formed. So the AVM itself wasn't a massive issue, but because of the blood flow into it, when the aneurysm formed, that was the big worry. So that's why they highly recommended that I went for treatment rather than just monitor it and you know, wait to see if something happened. For me, I was lucky when I found it, because what I was told was they were very confident it was going to burst in my lifetime. And because of the placement of it, it would either kill me or permanently paralyze me. So, yeah.
Wow. So it's a lot to take on. Again, you're only 29, aren't you? So, like I said earlier, that you're an inspiration is because let's just kind of go back and kind of talk to your operation, because there's a lot of people out there that don't know what you've been through, actually. And we come from, you know, you're a professional out in Cyprus. You know, when we was at Arsenal Academy, I know you was a year below me, but, you know, you was kind of, again, just to all the listeners out there, Ashley Goddard won a Wayne Rooney Street Cyclist Soccer. Was that in 2010?
Yeah, 2010.
Yeah, so, you know, so a lot of people, you've been kind of in the public eye, shall we say, in the UK, in Cyprus, really internationally, because you was out in America. So, you know, you're still only 29. We've got to appreciate that you're still very young. So, just kind of tell our listeners what you've been kind of going through from the operation, kind of. Yeah, I'll let you speak, Ashley.
Yeah, it's been difficult. There was basically three courses of treatment that they normally do. One is a full-on surgery where they go in through your skull, but I was told that the placement of mine, it was too dangerous to get there, so they couldn't risk that. That left two other things: an embolization and gamma knife radiation. With the radiation, they kind of put like a vice thing on your head and pinpoint the radiation to try and sort of burn it so it kind of blocks the blood pathway to it. But that was also said that there's only so much accuracy that they can get with that, so it was also too dangerous. So I was really only left with one option, and that was the embolization. And that basically is when they go in through a blood vessel in your groin and they feed this tiny wire all the way up to your brain, and they shoot glue for it to block it off. It's fascinating. I don't know how they do it, but they managed to seal off the aneurysm, and they've got about 60% of the AVM. So actually what I'm looking at the moment is I'm waiting for the results to a scan I've had recently to see what and if treatment is needed to follow up. But with regards to balancing of football and stuff as well, it's been difficult. There's not a lot of answers and stuff that I was getting. So it was like, can I play? Can't I play? So that was kind of going on all of last season.
Mm-hmm.
And then with the treatment, I got really unlucky. So I ended up having the embolization, but there was a 5-10% chance that you would suffer a stroke. Unfortunately, I did. So after the procedure, they do a test where they give you like a rating out of the most basic movements. So my left leg was like a 1 out of 5, my face had dropped, so that was a 1 out of 5, and my arm was 0. It was completely dead. They said that they weren't sure that I was gonna get the movement fully back, that it was unlikely. But they did tell me that the more I try and the more repetitions and things I do of exercises, hopefully the more I'll get it back. So I heard that and was like, okay then, well, I'll just do it nonstop. So for the first, it's been about 3.5 months now, but for the first 6 weeks, to be honest, I barely saw anyone. I just stayed at home and I did what they said. I did my rehab, rehab all day, every day. And when I go and have my scans, I always have to go back to the same hospital. So I got to go back to the hospital, and I made sure they took such great care of me. I took names of all the nurses and everyone that looked after me, and I got to thank them. And we had a good chat, and they said they said that they've had people younger than me come back from it, but they've never had anybody come back as quickly as what I came back.
That's your driven, aren't you? You're very driven. You want to get back out on the field. Was that your main goal, getting back out on that field?
If I'm being completely honest, no. It was
okay.
It wasn't. It was a pretty bad situation. I obviously it's incredibly hard for my family and stuff, but yeah. Honestly, it was bad. And so my big aims were: can I hold a cup again? Will I ever be able to use a knife and fork again? I had to relearn everything. I had to learn to walk again, to run again. I literally went through the stages. So, like when a toddler is super bouncy when they're running, that happened to me. it's been hard, but I know how lucky I am that my body has responded to the hard work I was putting in. Like there are people that have put in work and unfortunately won't get it back. But I think the sport inside of me helped, because doing the rehab and that was not a problem to me. They said, if you do the work, you're more likely to get it back. Okay, perfect. So that's what I did all day, every day, do my exercises. Now I'm unfortunately, you said previously before, but unfortunately I didn't actually sign for anybody beforehand, knowing that there was a slight chance that it wouldn't go to plan, which sadly happened for me. So I didn't sign for anyone beforehand. I'm still unsigned at the moment. I have been working and trying to see football wise, is it possible? Can I come back? And if I can, how do I want to do this? Do I want to come back and play for fun and for the enjoyment? Or do I want to make the mother of all comebacks? And try and play at a high level again. So we'll see. I'm giving myself. I'm training and I'm enjoying it again. There are definitely things that are frustrating. I've got to learn to do everything again. So I've got to make brand new pathways, and I still probably have treatment to go. So at the moment, I'm just taking it sort of week by week before I make a decision about how seriously I'm going to try and come back with football.
Yeah, I mean, it's a fantastic story though, Ashley, from how far you've come, what you've been through, and to where you are now. So literally, it's a credit to yourself and your determination. And you've got to kind of take credit, and it's fantastic. I've seen you a few days after your operation, and you look completely different. Really, really good. And it's just kind of spreading that awareness of this as well. It was you that come to us and said, "Look, guys, I've got this," and it took you guts to say it. And I think especially in the football world, people need to realize actually, there is things that can go on in people's lives that you don't know. And I just think, you are a credit to women's football. You're an inspiration to young girls growing up, to women now. So no, keep doing what you're doing. Again, the main thing is that you go back and enjoy football when and if that is. But no, really, really appreciate you coming on today and spreading awareness of AVM. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
You're more than welcome. So you can now join us from 5:15 p.m. UK time on Tuesday for our weekly look at women's football and the next special guest.
And now it's time for
football fans from around the world.
And this week we're joined by two Leicester City fans, Annie Lydon in Auckland, New Zealand, and Ray Davies in Melbourne in Australia. So I'll start with you, Annie. Welcome to the Early Doors Football Podcast. Can you start by telling us why Leicester?
Why Leicester? Well, I was born and raised in Leicester until I was about 13. And from about the age of 7, we lived in a pub called the Winstanley Arms. Big shout out to them. A big portion of the customer base that came in there were Leicester City fans. And so that kind of, I guess, got me aware of Leicester City at a young age. And then through the pub, we got some merchandise Leicester City merchandise that we got to give away to kids. I managed to pinch some of that, and it was called a kick it, I think. It was basically like a little net on the end of a retractable dog lead that you put a ball in. And so I would just spend hours in the car park on my own little self, kicking the ball around and learning how to, I guess, control the ball. And I guess that's where I fell in love with the game. Yeah.
And Ray, same question. How did you become a Leicester fan?
My auntie and uncle, they actually lived in Bradford, which is a lovely little country town near Leeds. And they moved to Leicester in 1973. And my uncle John was foolish enough to invite me to a game against Middlesbrough. And I had the opportunity to watch Leicester City at Filbert Street, or watch my favourite all-time film, Jailhouse Rock, Elvis Presley. I unfortunately ended up at Filbert Street watching Frank McClintock's worst team ever draw 0-0, and I'd never seen a game as poor in all my life. However, I'd fallen in love with the team then, so it's been history from there on.
And let's go back to the summer of 2015, ahead of Leicester's title-winning season, that amazing season that they had. Annie, can you remember what you were hoping for before the start of that season?
To be honest, just settling in for another bumpy season ahead. We just finished 14th after the back of quite an incredible run, 7 wins from 9. So it boded well going into the new season, but it's Leicester. So you just never know what to expect. And then add in there a new manager, Ranieri, who came with very mixed reviews from fans and pundits alike. And it was kind of really anyone's guess what would happen. Myself, I thought the bubble might burst at some point, and we'd probably finish somewhere in that 10th to 15th spot, which I would have been quite happy with. But I don't think I ever believed what was happening, and really until that Hazard goal. It took me right up until then to be like, yeah, okay, now we've actually won. I remember just sitting at my desk watching it on an iPad. It was about 8 or 9 in the morning, a very quiet finance office, and me jumping up and down, screaming and shouting, and everyone looking at me like, what's going on? So yeah, quite an incredible season, a moment in sports history, I think.
And how about you, Ray? What did you expect from that season?
With Leicester City, it's always, let's try stay in the Premiership. Finish 14th would be good. And this season really had no difference whatsoever. It was just a matter of staying in the division. And Claudio, as fantastic as he turned out to be, was a manager that could actually, he needed to spend money and get the right players in. Unfortunately, as history says, he did do that. But it was the usual struggle for Leicester City, in my humble opinion.
And Annie, back to you. At what point during the season did you think to yourself, actually, we might win this?
Yeah, I think the point where I was like, ooh, this could be happening. A lot of people say it was the Man City game over the Christmas period. But I think for me, it was probably more towards the end of January, start of February, where we got a few more results under our belt. And I thought, okay, I'm not going to tell anyone, but to myself, I've got a feeling this could happen. But yeah, it literally wasn't, I didn't want to count my chickens. And it wasn't till that Hazard goal went in, I was like, okay, now we can celebrate.
And same question for you, Ray. When did you think that Leicester could actually win the Premier League?
Yeah, well, it was scary because it was like with 10 games to go, there was a little bit of belief. And I'd watched Leicester home and away in England, and being in Australia were very difficult, but we used to get up at like 3 and 4 in the morning and think, oh my God, we're going to win this. And we actually had belief of going to Liverpool and Man City and winning games, which is not known really.
And in terms of your favourite memory as a Leicester fan, was it that season or something else, Annie?
It's up there, definitely. But for me, there's two others that I think are my best memories, because not for the football or the results, but for the emotion, I guess, of the game. So one was obviously the FA Cup win. That was one history making. I watched it with my family and my dad here And me and my dad share a passion for football and Leicester. So I know for both me and him, it meant a lot for us to be together at that moment. It was a 3 a.m. start, and then we ended with tears and bubbles at 6 a.m. So it sticks long in the memory. And then my first game, the first game of the 1920 season, it was away at Old Trafford. It's my very first Leicester away game. I just happened to be there on holiday. It was a Friday night. So it was quite a big occasion for me, I guess. And I only made it to the concourse where all the Leicester fans were singing before I started welling up. And then just walking to the seats was emotional. And then when Leicester finally walked out, sitting with all the away fans singing and chanting in Old Trafford, I just lost it and started bawling my eyes out, which my partner and my mate that I was with at the time thought was highly hilarious. But yeah, I guess for the emotions, they're two that stick in my mind.
And is the title season your best memory as a Leicester fan, Ray?
No, my favourite memory is watching Leicester City at Wembley beat Derby when Stevie Walsh scored. Stevie Walsh was always a bit of a hero of mine. He was a no-nonsense centre-half that knew where the net is, and he could battle for the team as well. So that was fantastic, because the year previous to that, we were beaten by Blackburn, and I think David Speedy played for Blackburn at the time and tripped himself up in the box for the penalty which they beat us on, which very, very upsetting at the time. And I'd never been to Wembley before, so to see Leicester lose there and then win there was absolutely probably the best time ever.
So, Annie, who has been your favourite Leicester player in the time you've supported them?
I guess of the current crop in the title-winning season, it's got to be Sharkey, so Michael Brighton. I just think his work rate and his ethic on the field, bless him, he's not the most skilled or quickest of the squad, but he's just all heart. And he just looks like he loves being out there playing football. I got to meet him a couple of times down at King Power, and he was just really nice. So, yeah, got to be Sharky.
And Ray, your favourite Leicester player?
I've got a couple or 20, but... my all-time favourite probably was Gary Lineker. Or Stevie Walsh, but going back a little bit, Larry May in the 1980s and Stevie Sims, Mark Wallington, had some fantastic times. And Tommy Wright, the guy that we bought from Leeds many years ago, he became a really good friend of mine as well. He lived in Bradford. So, and Ian Ormerod wasn't a bad player for Leicester, but I think Gary Lineker and Stevie Walsh were my favourites.
And final question to you both. Where do you think Leicester will finish this season? Annie, you first.
I think top four might be a bit of a stretch for us now. There's some teams that have really stepped up to the mark this season. If they carry on the way they are, then we're going to end up a bit lower down the table, I think. So, you look at the likes of like Brighton, that's another place in the top probably six if they keep going the way they're going that's gone. So I've gone for between 8th and 10th.
And Ray, where do you think Leicester will finish the season?
I have issues this season, to be honest with you. I just don't think Mr. Rodgers is playing the best team. He seems to have his favourites. I just don't think we've got the cohesion that we had with in his first season. There's people there that think they're bigger and better than the club nowadays, and we've not had that over the last 5 years. I just think he's lost the plot a little bit, Brendan, but I hope I'm wrong. So mid-table at the best for us, I think.
So in terms of a final position, what are your thoughts?
I'd probably say 10th.
Early Doors Football Podcast for football fans worldwide. If you want to get in touch with Mark and the rest of the team, you can reach them on earlydoors@forthenow.co.uk.